listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kurula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host of the most, Nikki Kurula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We are welcoming you back for not the first time or the second time, but the third time, Mr. Greg Leon. Greg, I'm over here.
Oh, hey, dude. What are you doing, man? You sound so far away. I wanted to bring you in closer.
It must be that old world map that you live in, dude.
Yes. Yes. Back in Pangea when all the continents were all connected.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I actually love how the world's view of the world has changed, and it's kind of a cool map. But I had to heckle you for it because I did say, what is that, your treasure map behind you, just in case? Yeah. And in case you were on a journey that you were not telling me about, I want in. I'm in.
Wouldn't that be something, though? Really?
Yeah. You know what? All those old movies, Indiana Jones, Goonies, those are like classics, and like I always secretly have wanted to go on a treasure hunt. So if you do stumble upon a treasure map of some sort, you better call your boy Nikki and say, hey, man, I need some brown magic on this journey. Can you come and find this treasure with me? And I will say yes.
I got a kind of a funny story for you. When we first got this house here when I was a kid, we had the people that introduced my parents together came up to see the house. I don't know if I should take my glasses off or what's better, glasses off or on?
Glasses off is cool. If you need them, you need them, you know?
Okay. Well, no, I'm okay. No, I'm kidding. So anyways, we get the house, and my dad's friends and my mom's friend, her best friend and my dad's best friend came up. They were married, and we're in the backyard, and he was a practical joker like me and you, you know, he's just a really funny guy. So I was in on the joke. So we went in the backyard, and there's an upper layer in the backyard, and it was just dirt back then. And so we're walking around showing him the property and stuff, and he takes this big chunk of gold. It's probably 2 ounces. I mean, it's just big, huge chunk of melted gold. And he just kept it in his pocket for good luck. Well, he drops it in the sand and kicks some dirt over it. My dad always was waiting for his ship to come in, as he said it. And he thought that, so he goes down and goes, what the hell did I just step on? And Ronnie goes down and he licks it up and lifts it up and he blows it off. My dad's name was Major. He goes, Major, look, I just found this in your property. You might be sitting on a gold mine. So he brushed it off and cleaned it off, and it's this nice piece of gold. And my dad's like, oh, thank God. I couldn't be more lucky. You know, that he was on a place that had gold on it, you know. But, and then, you know, my dad's all excited, and, you know, then it was a big joke, and my dad punched him in the neck, and that was it. No, I'm kidding.
Dad got the joke. That would be a harsh realization to, like, think you're sitting on a gold mine, literally. Yeah. And then realize your friend heckled you into thinking you were a millionaire. The dreams that were shattered at that moment.
You want to hear the worst one? I know we're not talking about music, but this is my dad.
Right. Do this.
My dad too. My dad, when the lottery first came to California, he was played it every week. Played the same numbers. It was $5 a week. It was $1 a thing. Had five cards in the game every week. And he'd been playing it for a couple of years. And my mom was like, come on, Major, you're always playing this thing. Nobody wins that thing, this, that, and the other. And guilted my dad out. Totally just made him feel like an idiot, you know. And maybe she's right. And he didn't play it that one week. Every one of his numbers came in.
Oh, my God.
Every one of his numbers. He couldn't even look at her after that. And she felt terrible because we'd been sitting on Easy Street now. And his dream was to hit that damn lottery and then put it in his kid's name.
Right, right.
You know, so... that never happened again. But that was, I was there. I saw the ticket and every one of his numbers came up and he was just sick for a week that he couldn't even hardly eat.
You know, what's so funny. My girlfriend's sisters came in to town and they brought one of them brought her grandson And he's
you had me a grandson.
And he was so adorable. But we were in the car, and her sister was like, you know, I bought $100 worth of lottery tickets, and I only got $20. And without missing a beat, this four-year-old kid, her grandson, says, that's terrible, baby. I was like, that is a rad response to that. But, man, I'm sure your dad has won the lottery many times over just watching you play and the way you do. And, Greg, you are a beast of a musician. I don't use those words lightly, but, man, you came into the studio when you recorded with us, and I just remember going, holy shit. Greg, I knew you could play, but I didn't know you could play like that. Like, when was that moment when you were a kid just kind of playing where you were like, oh, I know I can play? What was that moment for you?
Well, I used to play guitar for hookers. No, I'm kidding. no, you know, it's funny. I was just telling my wife this the other day. When I was a little kid, I grew up in Glendale, California, and we had a really bitchin' porch that we would sit on hot nights. My whole family, my dad would make popcorn. And, you know, melt some butter and put it on. And all the kids in the neighborhood would come. We'd bring a little TV outside and all of us would sit on it. It was awesome. And I would sit on the porch in the daytime because I'd see these old sharecroppers and stuff sitting on the porch, you know, rocking in a wheelchair, playing slide guitar. And I learned how to play slide guitar on my porch. And I played Slide on Your Record. But I just pretended that I was one of those old sharecroppers and tried to get into that thing with the vibrato that they had and the tone of the gruff voices and stuff. And I used to make all the neighbor kids laugh because they just thought, you know, God, Greg's a goofy guy. You know, he's playing all this crazy stuff and, you know, bending strings and getting sustain on my electric guitars. And they're like, why do you do that? And I'm thinking, well, I don't know. I saw B.B. King do it and I thought it was the coolest thing ever. Then I see Eric Clapton do it with that weird vibrato that he's got. And I'm going, I got to do that. That's the best.
How old are you? You were like a kid?
Oh, yeah. I was 12, 13, 14. I was a drummer from the time I was 11 till about 15, but I started playing drums at a guitar at 12, and I had a band at about 13 or 14. And I know when I knew I could do it. Here we go. I had a little band in junior high school, and they had a talent show, and I told the guys, "Hey man, we've been rehearsing. Let's just all we got to do is three songs. We get like 10 minutes. Let's just do it." So we rehearsed at my house in my parents' living room in Glendale. And in the morning of the thing, nobody had any cars. We're all in junior high. So the night before, we took some shopping carts and we put them up on the porch. And in the morning, we all met there and we loaded up the shopping carts. And it was a mile and a half down to the school. So we're on, you know, Glendale Avenue going all the way down to Roosevelt Junior High School. And we get there. And anyways, we did it. And the people went crazy. The kids went absolutely nuts. And the craziest we did Inside Looking Out by Grand Funk Railroad, which is awesome. A drug and prison song.
Right. And you were in middle school, you were in junior high, right?
Yeah, junior high. And then we did Johnny Be Good, you know, Johnny Winters meets Jimi Hendrix, the way I still do it when I play in Frank Marino. I love that. And we did Jumpin' Jack Flash, if I'm not, and that was Johnny Winters style. Well, there was 3,000 kids in my school, and there was two assemblies for the talent show, half the kids at one, half the kids at the other. Well, we did, you know, the first one and everybody was going crazy. Well, we did the second one and almost everybody cut the afternoon classes and came to see us. It was just people standing and obviously we won because the people are going crazy. But from that point on, people were having parties just so I could go play. They could have me play and my band play at those parties. And, you know, originally we knew maybe five or six songs. We're doing The Mule by Deep Purple. We're, you know, obviously Smoke in the Water. No keyboards, though. I had to cover all that stuff.
Well, I remember you told me that your dad would bring you to these parties that you would be playing at. And he knew there was something because kids were walking by and they're like, oh, man, I can't wait to hear Greg play.
Yeah.
That, like, what?
That was you got it half right. What happened was, in high school, we were playing for the city. They had a Halloween concert at Maple Park in Glendale, and it was up in the gymnasium, and it would probably hold, I don't know, 500, 800, maybe 1,000. And the city advertised it, you know, Greg Leon band, you know, a Halloween concert featuring Greg Leon. And it was in all the papers and stuff. And so we went and we soundchecked, we set up. And my dad was sitting in his car because I was, when I was little, I'm not talking about now, but I was a cute kid and there was you know, girls would say, oh man, Greg's so cute, or this, that, and the other, or they want to meet me. And their boyfriends would get mad. And my dad was always scared that a couple of guys would jump me and stuff.
Right.
Because he grew up in St. Louis, and people would just jump people and beat the shit out of them. So my dad was always protective of all of us kids. And so he was sitting in his car, and people were walking by, and the whole park was full of people going to this concert. And everybody's, you know, drinking drinks and smoking pot or whatever they're doing. And this is like 1975, something like that, 76. And if people kept walking by the car, and they kept going, hey, Leon's playing. You here to see Leon? Yeah, Leon's playing. And he's sitting there listening, goes, you know what? He must have something if everybody's talking about him. And so when I got home that night, he told me about that. He goes, keep doing what you're doing, Greg. Don't stop for nothing. If the guys in your band That's don't awesome. Want to do what you... I know. He was so supportive, and he loved me so much. And he just wanted the best for me. And we didn't have any money growing up. I mean, but what we had was a lot of music in the house. I have two great sisters and a mom and dad that were great. Both of my parents are gone now. But my dad was like, don't let anybody tell you can't do it. You can do it. Just stick with it. You obviously got something. He didn't understand the music I was doing. He didn't know about Jimi Hendrix.
I mean, you are like one of the best guitarists I've seen play in LA. And, it's like, you know, you and I are playing a show together. We're playing a show at the Whiskey May 31st. Yeah. One of the questions I wanted to ask you, because I don't think I've even asked you this on the phone. You play this venue many times.
Yeah.
I've never played this venue and always wanted to. Tell me a crazy or funny or strange or awesome story about you playing the Whiskey.
Well, there's a couple of them, but I don't know if there's
good.
How deep can I go?
You can go as deep as you want to go, man.
Okay, so we were opening up one time for what's his name? Randy Hansen, the Machine Gun guy. He does the tribute to Hendrix, the best there is.
Yep, he's a badass. He's a badass.
So we're playing. I don't even know if I should tell the story. This is just too
weird. No, please, go for it, please.
Is this a family show or just?
Yeah, it's all right. You can swear.
We're all adults here. Okay. I go down to play my show, and he's getting ready to play. So we come up after my show, after my set, and I knock on my door's locked to my dressing room, and I got all these people following me up there. You know, my band's there, all of our girlfriends and all the followers and stuff. I can't get in the damn room, and I'm knocking on the door, and I hear this guy go, "Hang on, man!" So he finally lets me in, or the door opens up, and Randy's got some chick bent over a chair, and they're just going at it. And I guess he pulled out and just, you know, did his business on the floor. And then he comes out and he goes, man, I'm sorry, man. I go, dude, that's really uncool to do. You know, we've been out here 15 minutes waiting to get backstage. So anyways, everybody comes in. It smelled like somebody poured bleach on the floor. It was just ridiculous. And I remember making jokes about it. You know, who does that to somebody, you know? So he comes back a minute later and he goes, dude, I'm so sorry. He goes, here, let me get you high. I go, well, I don't really smoke pot. That was never my thing. And so he goes, well, just, you know, I feel bad. You know, I just got back from Hawaii and I got some Maui Waui with me. And I figured, well, I'll probably never get the chance to, you know, hang out with him again. And so I took one hit off this weed, this joint that he had. He finished the whole joint. I was so fucked up. I mean, I closed my eyes and cartoons were playing. It was insane. And he goes down after smoking the whole joint and plays an amazing set like it was nothing.
Wow.
And I couldn't even stand to talk to anybody. I was so in my head. I was too crazy.
Right.
But that's one crazy story. I know you probably didn't think I came up with that.
That was amazing. Well, wait, you know what? Like, you were playing that show with him and you got super high. Were you like eating brownies before you went on? Like, how did you kind of motivate to like?
I had already played. Thank God I had already played, because I don't ever, I don't do anything before I play, and I don't do really anything. I drink a little beer now, but you know, the 80s are over. You know, I'm too old to be doing any of that crap, and I want to just be healthy and, you know, live. You know, I don't want to, so many of my friends have died from drug overdoses or, you know, just stupid stuff. You know, you got to grow up at some point. You're only a kid for a little while, but you're an adult the rest of your life, you know?
That's so true.
My dad always told me. My dad said, get it out of your system while young, because once it's over for good. You can't go back. But just be smart. Don't be stupid, you know?
That's wise advice, man. It's wise advice that most musicians don't listen to.
I know. And that's probably why I didn't make it to the big time, because I wasn't out getting high with everybody and schmoozing. I was at home practicing. You know, I wanted to be as good as I could be, because I had this vision for myself being a Jimi Hendrix fanatic, a Frank Marino fanatic, you know, Richie Blackmore fanatic, those guys, Johnny Winters,
yep.
Rick Derringer, all of those guys, man, they, to me, that was what you aspire to be. It wasn't, you know, some of these local guys that, you know, they didn't really have a background. They didn't really know where it came from and how to take it to the next level or whatever. So I was at home practicing or with, you know, whatever girlfriend I was with at the time. And I was not getting high or nothing like that. So, you know, the only time really people saw me was either hanging out at a party or playing live. And I wanted to keep it that way. I wanted to keep like a mystique up so that, you know, it wasn't just some guy, we can see Greg everywhere. You know, I thought of, you know, I read those Richie Blackmore books and the interviews, and nobody ever saw Richie Blackmore hardly.
Right.
You know, he wasn't out hanging out, you know, he was, you know, getting better, you know.
Right. I mean, that's I love that you say that, because I think about that a lot, because it's something that I always, like, it's like the monkey on your back. Like, you always have to practice. You always have to play.
Yeah.
I was actually practicing right before because I saw this guy. You know who Eric Steckel is?
I don't think so.
Oh, my God. This kid, you're going to love. I saw him. He blew my mind, man. It was really impressive. Very good, like, heavy metal rock blues player. But, like, you know, he's a young cat, and he just shreds. I mean, he just – he was mind-blowing. You would really love him. But, I mean, I saw him, and I was like, man, I got to practice. Like, I just literally was like, I got to go home right now. When you see somebody like that, it makes you want to go home and practice right away. It doesn't make me like, yeah. I'm like, yeah. Dude, what am I doing here? This is going to be fine. But as soon as I go home, I'm going to practice, you know.
That's funny you said that. There was a guy, you guys have probably never heard of, a guy named Yngwie Malmsteen.
Oh, I know Yngwie.
I'm kidding. Of course you've heard of him. So his first gig in America, I just did an interview for a book they're writing on him. And they were asking me about, you know, the first time I met him or whatever. And I remember doing the sound check at the Troubadour, and people kept coming up to me because I was like the hotshot guitar player in town at the time. And, you know, Eddie had gotten picked up. Randy had left. I played with, you know, Quiet Riot. When Randy left, I took his spot. It was the docking thing. So everybody was, you know, watching to see, thinking I was going to be the next guy that gets picked out of it. And I thought so too, but whatever. So they asked me, well, what was it like playing with opening up for him? And so everybody's saying, dude, you got to see this guy. It's like nothing you ever seen before. The guy's amazing. It's the fastest, cleanest, most amazing guitar player. There's nothing like it. So I go, well, okay, well, you piqued my curiosity. I'll play along. So I waited and I watched their sound check. And this kid comes in with a 50-watt half stack and one, I'm pretty sure he just had one pedal. It was a little yellow pedal and a Stratocaster. And my mouth just about fell to the floor. I'm like, oh, my God. And you said it made you want to go home and practice. I'm thinking, what in the hell is the point? How can anybody get that fast, know that much about music, and be that fluid with it, and just all over the neck and so clean? And it was just beautiful. Beautiful. It was like a violin, like a concert violinist playing. Oh, boy.
Well, I mean, it's funny that you say that, too, because it's like sometimes it makes you want to stop just because you see how crazy detailed people can be and how good they can get. And it's like, and you know, in their head, they're like, oh, I missed some notes or whatever, because they're just
putting
themselves up like artists do. But I mean, it's an interesting point, because sometimes it makes you want to stop, and then it's like, no, I got something, let me play, let me pick that up. Like,
after their sound check, not to interrupt you, Nikki, the sound check, I go, man, I gotta meet this guy, because he is really something. I mean, really is something as a guitar, from guitar player to guitar player. This guy's better than anybody. So I go back. I see him walk up the stairs to go upstairs, you know, to the dressing room there. And I go up there and I see him on one knee tying a shoe. And I rock over to him and I reach my hand. I go, dude, I got to tell you, man, you're probably the best guitar player I've ever seen. And he looks at me, yeah, I know.
What?
Seriously? He didn't shake my hand. And I'm sitting there with my hand out. I'm just going, what the hell? What the hell, man? What am I, an idiot here, you know? So, you know, I picked my ego up off the floor and I walked out and caught his show that night. Flash forward years later, and a buddy of mine, Albert Morris, had a band called Third Stage Alert, and Yngwie produced their record. And so we all went to dinner at the Rainbow one night when Yngwie was playing at the, I think it was called the Avalon back then on Vine. And so we all met and, you know, it was just the four of us hanging out. Yngwie's wife, my buddy, Albert, and me. And, you know, we had a great dinner. You know, we had pizza and got as fat as we could. And then we went to the thing and watched the show. And we're backstage after the show. And everybody's telling Yngwie stories and jokes and stuff. And I got one for you guys. So everybody, yeah, what do you got? And I tell him about that story, and his wife comes up and slaps him on the chest. And she goes, see what I told you? You can't be an asshole to people because nobody forgets. I go, no, man, that's one of the best stories I got. I love it. And he goes, Greg, did I really say that? I go, yeah. He goes, oh, my God. You know, he was so full of them. But he was, you know, how could you not be stuck up?
Right.
If everybody's right. telling you they're the best they've ever seen. Well, you know, when you're in a new country and everybody's doing that for you.
But like you look at somebody like Jimi Hendrix and like he was never about that. Like he was the best, and like he may have known it, but he was like, nah, you know, that's not what it's about. So like some people have that where it's like they see how vast it is, and some people are like, I'm at the top of the mountain, there's no mountain higher. So
you know, two of the coolest people I've met, one of them was Eddie Van Halen, and we hung out one night and partied at a club called the Woodsound that we used to play at all the time. And we hung out till about 2:33 in the morning from about 10 o'clock one night, just partying, handing a guitar back and forth.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh my God, this is like the best guy since Hendrix. And here I am, just the owner of the club, Eddie and me. And I mean, that was life changing. I mean, we're just sitting there talking, just shooting the shit like we are right now. And he was so cool. Wow. Absolutely. Just incredible. And, there was somebody else that was really cool too.
And you also have that story where like David Lee Roth and Eddie came to see you when you were in high school, and they were like standing right next to you, and like you know, they came in and they were asking you questions about how to like bend the bridge and all. It's like so epic, dude. I mean,
that blew my mind. And I knew they were somebody, but I didn't know who they were. I didn't never heard of Van Halen back then. And we're playing at the Chevy Chase Country Club. A buddy of mine had a party there, and there's probably 300-400 people in this rec room there, the entertainment room at this golf course. And I see these two guys walk in. They're kind of standing at the door for a while. Then they're standing right in front of me, and I've got a 63 Jaguar at the time in high school, and I'm doing dive bombs and, you know, splitting harmonics and, you know, doing the bombs dropping and all that stuff like Frank Moreno and Hendrix did. And Eddie is talking to me. I didn't know who he was. Hey, man, how do you get that to go so low? And I told him about how I took the spring and stretched it out, and so I get more travel on the thing and the way I tie my put the strings on it. And, you know, a couple of years later, Glendale College concert, it's Quiet Riot and Eddie and Van Halen. And they walk out. I go, oh, my God, that's those two guys. Oh, my God.
Like, damn it. Well, let me ask you. You were trading solos and stuff with Eddie. Just
We're not trading solos. We're just sitting there showing each other licks or playing. And, hey, man, how did you do that?
That's what I was asking. What did you show him? What did you show him?
I didn't show him anything. I've showed Randy stuff, but I never showed Eddie anything. God, who could show at that time? Nobody knew more than he did.
So Eddie would play something and then hand you the guitar. How did you have the confidence to be like, yeah, I'll show you?
I've never been like that. I have friends that won't play around, and they're good guitar players, but they won't play in front of me, which to me is ridiculous.
Right.
You know, we're just buddies. We've been friends. One of my buddies, 30 years, we've been best friends. He won't play in front of me.
Wow. That's
crazy. It's just, come on, really?
Right. Right.
What do you think's going to happen? You think I'm going to judge
badass. You are a badass, so it makes sense. But that must have been like a huge kind of like rite of passage that you were going through, just like, oh, I can play, and here I am with one of the greatest of all time.
Absolutely. You know, and then, you know, years later, you know, Randy gets picked up to go with Ozzy, and Kevin and Randy call me one morning, and we rehearsed at the same place they did. We'd done a bunch of shows together. Randy and I were buddies. Hey, man, you know, Randy, just, and I didn't know. He goes, Randy just got the gig with Ozzy. I go, really, Randy? He goes, yeah, I'm quitting. He goes, we both think that you're the best guy in L.A. to take my spot, you know, in the band. Do you want it? You want to take my place? He goes, but if you take it, then you got to take over all my students too. So I went from like no students to like, I think it was 68 or 86, something like that. It was a crazy amount of it's a full-time job, 8 hours a day, 6 days a week. Wow. And I did it. Didn't lose one student, picked up a bunch more, and you know, learned their songs. And I told him, I go, I'm not going to play Randy licks. I'm going to play Greg Leon licks. You know, some of the stuff that's like signature things, of course I'll do, but to learn something note for note from somebody else to me is retarded. Right. I might as well be in a tribute band.
Right.
And so we did that for, I don't know, 8 months, a year. And then Kevin at the time was super hard to get along with. And there was a lot of friction with him. The other guys in the band were great. I love Drew. I still talk to Drew, the drummer. He's great. But, you know, and some things happened that I didn't appreciate too much. And Don Dokken kept calling me and So we did a gig together in a place called the Rock Corporation, and he just loved the, what I did and the way I could sing too. He wanted to be in a band where there was harmonies.
That's awesome.
So yeah. And he had been after me for a couple of years, and he said the magic words, and that was, I have European dates. And I'm thinking, wow, that's awesome. That's what happened to Hendrix. Maybe I could be the next, you know? So I agreed to it. I said, sure. So we started rehearsing. I left the Dubrow camp, and, 28 days or 21 days later, we're on a plane going to Europe, and we're writing song. Donna and I are sitting together writing lyrics. What do you think of this? I changed that. If I, you should change that, because that's phonetically not right. And we wrote all these lyrics, and we went and played a bunch of shows, had a great time. And from what Don told me, I just spoke to him when Jeff Beck passed away. We got back in touch with each other, and we talk every once in a while. But he was talking about that he got his deal with Elektra from the demos that I did with him, with Dieter Dierks producing. I never knew that. I just thought, you know, we did these demos, and I didn't know if he shopped them or not. And yeah.
What kind of stuff did you show Randy, or did you guys show each other?
Well, you know, the Crazy Train riff? That's my riff. But when it goes into the verse, that whole riff part was a thing that I had for one of my songs in the band I had called Sweet 19. It was a song called Every Time. And that he loved that. And I go, dude, all it is the chords to Swingtown by Steve Miller, just sped up and turned around, you know, the order of them, and just put a different swing on it, you know. And he loved it, and he had me show it to him. I showed it to him. The next thing I know, it's like the biggest thing they did together.
Wow. But, yeah. You were like, damn it.
Yeah, and in the book, there's a book out by on Black Sabbath called Symptom of the Universe, and they give me credit for that. So that was nice.
That's
to get
amazing.
A,
That's amazing.
Thank you for that, yeah. Because I've had so many riffs and songs stolen from me. And, man, all through the 80s, I'd turn on MTV, and there'd be another riff I wrote with a band, Quiet Riot, or another riff I wrote with Dokken, or, God, there's so many bands. There was a band called... King Cobra with Carmine Appice in it. And there was a guy, Mike.
Great drummer.
Oh, he's one of the awesome. Mike,
we were talking about that. We were talking about this the last interview a year ago, how Beck Bogart, Appice.
It's really Appice, but he goes by the name of Peace.
Right.
Because everybody wants a piece of a piece. That was this catchphrase when he was, you know, promoting all these drum things. But, what were we talking about? I got sidetracked.
We were talking about Jeff Beck. You were saying you saw so many riffs, and you had this conversation with.
Just so many riffs that, you know, bands that. Oh, so it was King Cobra. That's what we're talking about. So years later, somebody had a King Cobra record, and Mike had auditioned for me, and Mike ended up, I think they recorded at his studio, Atlanta Studios, but he had auditioned for me, and I gave him a 3-song demo of the songs to learn. And sure enough, those damn songs ended up on the first King Cobra album, and they just changed them around a little bit. But the major riffs of it was my music.
Right.
And I had no idea, and I didn't find out till like 10 years later. And I went to the audition. They had a Alan somebody, or Alan Miller was the manager, and the guy was, you know, a total, you know, limp wrist guy. And I was up in the office, and I'm going, man, I don't know if I want to be involved with it. I love Carmine and Vinny's drumming. They're my favorites. But it just seemed so weird. And then I went over to the house where they were getting together, and it was just, I don't know, man. Carmine wasn't there. It was just these guys, and it just didn't seem right for me, so I passed on it. And then they kept those songs, and they couldn't come up with riffs. So, hey, Mike, what do you got? You got anything? He hands them the Greg Leon music, and they ended up using it. They didn't get no credit for it.
That's crazy.
You know, just snakes, just asshole snakes. And, you know... I don't know, man. There's some people get all the way through life just stealing stuff from people.
You know, it happens a lot. And there's also like, there's a little bit of luck that has, you know, something to do with it. You know, and I've thought about that too, because yeah, I've been sober something like 21 years, something like that.
Why?
And it's like, well, I wanted it to be like, I wanted to be super focused on music. It was like, I've always wanted to apply myself, and that was it. And you said something really funny. You're like, I always wonder if I didn't get breaks because I wasn't always partying and stuff. And, you know, I think about that too, because a lot of the industry, they're drawn to the industry for the sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And a lot of that is that partying lifestyle. So it's like, it's really weird. It's a really strange, you know, kind of like a group of people that all are put together in this music industry. So it's like, but the amazing thing is, like, here you are still standing making music and making kick-ass music. And you know what? You can still play with the best of them. And you still shred. Let's play something. What do you want to? We're going to play Stormbringer first, since you're about to bring the storm that's about to happen tomorrow. So,
all right. Well,
Here's Stormbringer by Greg Leon Invasion.
I happily accept these awards on behalf of my band.
That's right. Multi-platinum. That's the way it should be, right?
It's got to be, damn it. It's been too long.
I got to tell you, too, like, first of all, what a great riff for that song.
Oh,
that is a rockin' riff. I don't know how that's not the first single off the record, because, man, I got to tell you, You always write great riffs, but that is a riff of riffs.
You know, that's funny you mentioned riffs, because that is my problem with all of the new bands coming out and all these little sissy, whiny guys. There's no riffs. They're playing cowboy chords. There's nothing that you can remember.
Yeah.
You know, if you, Ritchie Blackmore always had a riff. There was always something that was an intro guitar cool thing, you know, and Black Sabbath, there was always a bitchin' guitar thing. And that's what always...
Hendrix, Stevie Ray Vaughan, all those guys, they all had riffs. It's like, yeah. I love riffs.
Yeah, I want to be the riff master, you know, come up with stuff. And
I want to ask you real quick about the, you recorded it. I love how you recorded it. And, you know, you had it come in right at the top on the right. And then you had it doubled on the left. Were you just kind of like wanting to make like this kind of like, you know, music yes. sculpting kind of yeah. like, because I mean, it sounds so big. It's so big. And it's just it's a rocking tune. I mean, it is. It's definitely a single. You should.
You know, I've had this song for a long time, and I've recorded it with a bunch of different bands. But until I got this band together with Ronnie Siago on drums and Rick Brandt on bass, Rick plays in the LA Phil. He's like first chair cello.
Yeah.
Guy's amazing. My drummer studied under Carmine Appice in New York for years.
Wow.
He's played on over 450 CDs. He played in black with Ritchie Blackmore for a little bit. You know, him and Ritchie are friends. He was this one kills me. He was Bill Ward's drummer for like 15 years in the Bill Ward band.
Wow.
You know, the guy's got to be great. And
you play just from that riff, that little riff that he does in the break.
Yeah.
It's like that. It's so badass.
Well, I love him so much that I told him, dude, I got to put a solo of yours on my record. That's the battle. You know, and it's who the hell does a drum solo on an album anymore?
Yeah.
But it's beautiful. And at the end, there's a big shotgun that goes off with a bunch of reverb on it. And then the riff comes back in. And it just takes you on out.
I mean, what I love is like you have arrangement, you have melodies. This is actually one of my favorite vocals I've heard you do, too.
That's my least favorite.
Like you are just gunning it. And it's just,
yeah,
it's got so much vibe, man.
I was screaming. You know, it's funny because my drummer, we had done the track. And my drummer goes, put a vocal on it. And I go, well, I don't really have anything set up. He goes, set something up. So I got my 47 microphone, my U47. I just yelled into it just to get a take, you know, so we could hear how it's going to sit. And we all looked at each other again. No, it's not too bad, really. It's one take. And we'd kept it. You know, we just moved on to the
word,
next
one. What was the word that you sang that eventually came into Stormbringer? Or did you start with Stormbringer?
No, I've had this song for a long time. Long time.
That's wild.
I almost called the album Stormbringer, but there's a Deep Purple album called Stormbringer. And when I mentioned that to people, they go, no, you don't want to do that. You know, you're not. Right. And I tell them, I don't do cover songs. It's my own song.
Right.
And so I start
talking about Children.
Tell the Children is a son of a gun song, man. It's heavy. It's got a phenomenal message in it. That's what I'm going to call the record. And so that's what we called it.
I love the record. It's actually, I've got a couple of your records, and all of them are riff heavy, which I love. All of them have good song structures. Tell me, when you go into the studio, and I know you're doing this, like, you're doing it all on tape, because you're one of those old school guys like I am, too. I love tape. There's nothing like it. Tell me, like, when you went into the studio, what was your
approach? I own my own studio, so I don't have to, it's here at my house. I've got an outbuilding that's a recording studio here in Mount Christina. And as soon as I did the last mix on this record, I put a 24 track tape machine in my studio. This is done on 16 track half inch. And for like 20 years, I was looking for the right tape machine, a 24 track that was local, because all of them were back east and you can stuff, but weighs a million pounds. I found some guy that was a broker, and he had bought a whole studio out. And I just happened to see the corner of it, Craigslist. I called the guy up. Is that a 24 track machine? He goes, yeah. I go, is it for sale? He goes, yeah. I go, can I come look at it? He goes, yeah. So the next morning I went down and looked at it, came up with the price that we could both deal with, and I brought it home. And then it sat in my living room. And you know, I'm an electronics guy. I made all new Megami cables for it.
Wow.
24 tracks and 48 wires coming out of the back. And I just started buying more outboard equipment. I upgraded to a 32-channel board. I want to get a 96-channel board.
Wow.
But I don't have the place for it. That's the thing. I don't have that big of a studio. It's 25 by 20. And there's
And I love that you do demos like that too. It's like,
yeah, oh yeah.
I mean, that is like, for me, when I go into a recording studio, like, you've been to Doug's. When I go into
that guy's amazing. That guy is amazing.
He is awesome, and he is.
I had no idea that guy had that he did when I was with you in the studio, and I told you that day, and I'll say it. I've done a lot of sessions. That was the best session that I've ever been part of. That wasn't my.
I love that. That's such a huge honor. Awesome. Well, I mean, you're going to sit in with us at the whiskey. You're going to play the track that you played on the record because it's just burning. And dude, you did like one take. It was like, it was crazy. But
I do that all the time. I tell people, I don't even want to hear the song that I'm going to play. Let me hear it once, twice. Let me see what comes to my head and where it, and if you like it, we'll keep it. If not, tell me what you want. But let me just do that thing that, you know, that I do, you know. And you wanted slide. I'm going, wow, this is cool.
It was, you know, so. And I didn't know you could play like that. Like, I knew you could play, but like when you started, and you know, before we started recording, you were just riffing, and I was like, oh my god! Like, I literally said under my breath, like, oh my god, shit's about to explode right now. And when you recorded that track, it's actually one of my favorite tracks on the record, just because of that slide part.
I have to admit, it's my favorite too.
I mean, it really is. I mean, honestly, it's like. It's a killer way to open the record. I've always wanted to open a record with it, and I knew that's what it needed on the track. But, dude, I will be honest with you. I know a lot of people that play slide. I don't know a lot of people that play slide like you play slide. Oh, wow. And it was just wailing. It was so good.
Well, thank you, man. I just try to be tasty with it. You know, there's I think the best slide player, my personal opinion, is that Trucks guy.
Derek Trucks. Oh, yeah. Trucks.
Oh, my God. That guy's like in another world. It's incredible. Yeah. I mean, I hear all these guys and everybody says it's so great. I hear them like they're not doing nothing.
Well, it's just a world, you know what? There are people that have signatures. He's one of them.
Oh yeah.
And you play with that kind of fire too, though, Greg. I mean, it's pretty awesome. Well, do you always play with the slide? Just like it's on you whenever you're playing a gig, every song, or do you take some songs off?
No, there's certain slide because I do a different tuning for slide. I use open tunings for slide, so I can't do that.
All open D or open G or open E?
No, it's open A.
Okay.
Usually it's an A chord that's just open, like Johnny Winter said. That's how I learned how to play slide. I was enamored with what Johnny Winter was doing on the Johnny Winter and Live record. I couldn't believe that it was so bitchin'. And I went to see him at the Forum in high school. And I've been trying to figure out what the hell is, how was he, because there was no internet then. You couldn't figure out how to, you had to know somebody that knew somebody that, you know. So I went and saw him at the Forum and I was second row. A friend of mine went there and he got sick and I caught him leaving. And I go, Brent, where are you sitting? He goes, second row. I go, where are you going? He goes, man, I think I got the flu. I'm going, oh, I go, give me your ticket. I'm way in the back. He's second row. I'll give you your ticket Monday at school. So I sat there and I watched Johnny Winter's play, and I'm just like, that's my hero. And he's right in front of me. I'm second row, right up front. And I saw him tune it, and I'm going, oh, that's what he's doing. That's an A chord. And I just watched it for that 1 or 2 hours that he was playing, and I was up front. I went home and tuned the guitar, and from that point on, I figured out how to play slide. I started doing Johnny Winter, like Mean Town Blues and Dallas and all these songs that he had on those records. It all just made sense. Wow. But you had to know how to tune it or you couldn't do it.
Right. And it's just like there's certain points on the neck that you can hit that you know it's what's going to sound like butter. But you have that feel. It's like swampy. It's like gritty. Yeah. It's like all those things. And you know what? I know the guys in your band also, like when you're all playing, well, the coolest thing about being in a band is like you try to impress each other. It's like you want that respect. And I'm sure they look at you like they're like nodding half the time when you're – riffing and just playing these wailing.
I gotta tell you, the guys I play with are pretty hard to impress. So I gotta bring it. I gotta bring it. Yeah, I can't slouch out because these guys have played with some of the biggest guys around. And but I've always brought a lot of fire to my playing, and I can't ever phone it in, or I don't want to be part of it. I've got to be on. I've got to be pushing my limit at the very minimum, and just. Try to bring it so it's exciting. Like I used to get excited to watch people play when they were really doing it. And I tried to do, I don't know if I do it, but I try to.
Oh, you definitely do it. And you know what? One of the things I wanted to do with shaping this interview, I wanted to talk about your songwriting and this next song we're going to play. It really showcases that. I think the song's called Hold On, right? Yep. We're going to play Hold On, and then we're going to talk about how your record's being pushed and you signed a deal and all that stuff. Here's Hold On by Greg Leon Invasion. Tell the children. I like it. Tell me about the album cover. Tell me about the spaceship.
Well, my wife actually came up with the concept for the album cover, and she made some t-shirts up with just me in a position playing my guitar, and there's a bitchin' spaceship she designed, and there's a beam coming down, and I'm in the beam, and she was selling these things, and I made a bunch of them up, that's what I wanted for the album cover. So my bass player, I guess he knew some guy in Australia, some famous guy that does like really futuristic stuff like Frank Frazetta. And so he got in touch with him. The guy loved the idea. He worked up some renderings and he sent them to us. And we had about, I don't know, 4 or 5 spaceships. And, you know, it's a shame because this spaceship on here is so bitchin' when you look at it big. But when it shrunk down, it doesn't look like it's that spectacular, but it's incredible, the detail on the thing and just all the stuff.
That's what I don't love about CDs.
I know.
It's like, I know. Man, you just don't get that full-fledged experience. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Still cool, man. It's still cool. I like that you're all in the B, man. So, yeah. You know what? I actually hear like some hints of Boston in some of the...
Boston's one of my favorite all-time bands.
I hear it. I definitely hear it in that song.
And, you know, my voice, and you know, people say, God, you sing in falsetto. I never sing in falsetto. I don't do falsetto. I just have a high range. You know, I can't sing real low. My dad always wanted me to try to sing like Sinatra because my dad was a great singer, and he was like a mix between Sinatra and Elvis Presley, but he liked those lower things because that was big in the big band era.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was into Steve Marriott, you know, and the guys that belted out, and, you know, Robert Plant and Ronnie James Dio.
Yeah.
I'm one of those power guys. That's what I wanted to be, you know.
Well, I mean, that there's something that's like, whoa, when you hear that. When you hear that high tenor voice just like screaming like a wailing guitar, there's something really like.
Exactly.
You can't help but pay attention, you know.
And luckily, I still got my voice at my age because there's so many guys that I used to play with. If they're not dead, they can't sing anymore.
Because they used to smoke or drink or like whatever, et cetera, et cetera. It's like
they didn't take care of that voice, you know. And my wife's a singer. She took opera. And she taught me how to breathe better when I'm singing. And that, as you know, I mean, you're a super accomplished singer.
Thanks,
it's all about breathing.
Yep.
You know, and not singing from here, but singing from your diaphragm. But that breathing, you've got to have air in your throat. Otherwise, you're beating your vocal cords together.
I actually feel like I never get vocal fatigue when I sing. But if I'm on the road and you have to, like, talk with fans and stuff.
That's what I hate. I hate the talking. That's what kills me.
Yeah, and you have to do it if, like, you're trying to schlep gear and also win fans over to get them on email lists, make CD sales. So you have to do it. So it's like you have to just learn where you have to fight your battles, you know. So, but I mean, that's the life and the career that we're going for, and it is what it is. Tell me a little bit about the songwriting inspiration behind the song. Hold on.
Well, part of it was, you know, for years I was a super light sleeper, but I got married kind of late in life. I married my wife. I think I was 40 and she was 39, I think. And I would just look at her laying there and think how lucky I am. You know, she'd be sleeping and I would just look at her and just go, man, you know, how lucky am I to have a gorgeous wife like that? That's super, super cool.
Right.
She's a musician. She gets what I'm about. She never gives me any grief about any of the things that I start chasing or my hobbies. I mean, I've got 30 fish tanks in my studio, in my shop, not my studio, awesome. But my shop. Because I'm a fish guy. I love fish. I've been in fish since I was 6 years old. She never once says, and I got a 125-gallon tank in the living room in the wall and a 60-gallon tank in the living room. Plus, in my shop, I got 30 tanks or 28 tanks. You know, and, you know, I buy all the studio gear, but she's smart. She knows that she's going to benefit from that because when we do her records, she's got the best of everything. It's all analog. I got a, you know, 24-track tape machine, a really nice board, and every piece of outboard gear equipment. I'm always upgrading.
Right.
So, you know, she's a great partner. I mean, I could not imagine being with anybody else. I really couldn't, and I mean that with all my heart.
That's awesome.
Yeah, she's something else. And about a week after I met her, I knew she was the one. Because my dad, getting back to my dad, he goes, these other girls, yeah, they're going to come and go. You know, there was always girls around following me and what. Do whatever. And he goes, don't get too involved with them. He goes, you're going to meet some girl from a small town. It's going to be that piece of your life that's missing. You're going to feel whole again. But the only time you're going to feel good is when you're with her. When you're not with her, you just can't wait till the next time you're with her. And my wife came to see me play a show at the House of Blues in Hollywood. We did a show.
I miss that venue.
I miss it too. That was the best place in LA, man. Yeah. Since the Starwood, it was amazing. So we played, it was about 800 people there, and she had talked to me on the phone a couple of times because she needed somebody to play some guitar work for her. And she came backstage to meet me, and we just started talking, and she was just so gorgeous and so cool, and she's just so unassuming. And come to find out, she's from the smallest town. Her parents owned the hunting and fishing lodge in Prince Rupert, Canada, about 20 miles away from anything. It was... You couldn't get in a smaller town. It was there. They owned the town. And it was all the things my dad told me, you know, missing her when I wasn't with her. I couldn't wait to get with her. And I'd wait for that phone to ring when she was available. And we ended up, you know, hanging out. And one day she just goes, hey, if we feel this strong in 2 years, ask me to marry me.
Wow.
And I said, okay. So I waited for that 2 years. And when it hit, I asked her, she said, yes. We honeymooned over in Hawaii, and it's been a honeymoon ever since. And it's
that's awesome. So it's an ode to her.
Over 20 years now.
Wow.
About 22 years now, 23 years.
We've been. Well, I hope she comes to the whiskey, man, to see you rock and play with us too, man. You know,
she probably will. She likes to keep an eye on me. No, I'm kidding.
So you wrote this as a love song to her, basically.
Yeah, that's where the inspiration for the lyrics came from. I remember looking at her, you know, when early in the morning and her sleeping like a little baby, a little girl, and how lucky I felt that, you know, she was even into me, because there was all kinds of guys after her when I met her.
Right.
I mean, there was guys calling all the time, but she saw something in me, and
you're like, thank God.
Thank God. Yeah, exactly.
So let's talk about, like, you just signed a record deal and they're putting this record out.
Well, I actually signed it back in May, and the record just came out last week on the 10th, I think, of March. So it's been a hell of a long wait, 9 to 10 months.
And do they want to wait, like, past the pandemic, all the, like, post-pandemic stuff? Like, what was the reasoning behind it?
You know, I don't know what the actual reasoning was. You know, this is the first time, well, the second time actually that I had a lawyer shop it for me. The other times I shopped it, and every time I signed a deal that I didn't have looked over, I got screwed every single time. But it might have been part of it was the pandemic, and they didn't know where the music was going, if, you know, what was going to happen with these shutdowns and stuff. So they might have just sat on it. But it's come out. It's actually getting really good reviews. It's getting a lot. That's awesome. I think it's selling, because my Facebook thing is just completely lit up. I mean, with people saying they love it. If they didn't buy it, I don't know how they would love it. And so I think that's good. And I know the label's taken out half page ads in, like, the big trade magazines, and it's a major label. So, you know, I'm excited about that. And it's distributed through the Orchard, Bob Frank Distribution. And I'm excited, you know. Unfortunately, it didn't happen 30, 40 years ago when people would buy millions of records.
Yeah, but you know what? It happened when it did, and it needed to happen, so it's good.
Well, you know, and it might have been something, you know, God saving me from getting killed like so many of my friends once they made it, you know, or, you know, getting involved with the wrong people and drugs or whatever. It just, you know, I wasn't cut out to, you know, I'm a pretty sensitive guy, and, you know, I go with my feelings, and if something doesn't feel right, I can't be part of it, you know, and.
Well, let's play the last track before we run out of time. Okay. Here's Greg Leon Invasion with Always the Same. I need you. your bad self. Greg, we're running out of time, but real quick, where can people find you online and tell people where they can get the record?
Just go online and go Greg Leone Invasion. Tell the children. It'll come up, or greginvasion.com. There'll be links to – it's available everywhere. I mean, it's at Target. It's at Walmart. Everywhere. It's over in Europe. I mean, in Australia, United Kingdom, everywhere. Super easy to get. You can download it, or you can buy the physical CD. And everybody that's gotten it. So my every day, my emails are just lit up with people saying how much they love it. And it's such a great, like going back in time. It's like old friend, but it's all new to them.
Record is it's exciting. It's all like, I mean, even parts of that sound like Zeppelin, and then like it has like that, you know, hard rock presence too. It's just so many elements of music that I love that are in it. And man, I'm excited. We haven't played a show together. And you have no idea how it's a huge honor for me to play a show with you. So
It wasn't like you didn't try to do shows with me, though.
That's true. But this one we're actually going to do, and how fitting that we're doing with the whiskey. And I promise not to bum rush your dressing room and lock you out of it.
Oh, geez. I don't want to go through that again. That bleach business is too much, man.
Well, on behalf of Greg Leone, myself, and Sam, we're going to be playing together Wednesday, May 31st at the Whiskey A Go-Go, where Jimi Hendrix, The Doors, Zeppelin, I mean, you name it, they all played there. And
Van Halen,
that's right. Oh, my God. So it's going to be an amazing show. I'm honored to have you on the bill. It's going to be an amazing show.
It will be very fun.
We will rock.
In fact, I opened up for Metallica the first time they played in L.A. If you look at that marquee at the bottom of it, says Greg Leone. It's crazy.
Well, you're going to have to tell that story. You're going to have to tell that story at the whiskey. But for now, check out Greg Leone Invasion. Get his record. Tell the children. On behalf of Greg, myself, and Sam, we'll see you guys next week. Peace and love. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other.
Listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.